Hello and welcome everyone to Post-Traumatic Stress in Military Families, part of the training series, the Invisible Injuries, Treating the Invisible Injuries of War, sponsored by the Coming Home Project, UCSF Health Effects of War Grand Rounds, and UCTV. This is being broadcast live around the country. And we welcome you wherever you are from this. We're broadcasting here from Herbst Hall at UCSF in San Francisco. I'm Joseph Bobro, and I'm the founder and president of the Coming Home Project. Before we begin and I introduce our presenters, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Coming Home Project. We're a group of psychotherapists, veterans, family members, and interfaith leaders devoted to addressing the emotional and spiritual relationship and reintegration challenges faced by Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their family members, and also their service providers. We provide education and training, and this series is one of our programs in this area, free psychological counseling in Northern California, and innovative residential retreats that build peer support networks and constructive coping mechanisms and stress management tools for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their families. Those retreats are currently offered in California, although we bring in people from around the country to attend them free of charge. And soon we will be offering them elsewhere in California and also around the country. It's my pleasure today to introduce two highly experienced people in the area of working with family members affected by the service of their husband, wife, or child. We know that trauma does not just affect the individual. It affects everybody associated with the individual. And family members say that when the soldier or Marine or airman or sailor go to war, the family goes with them. So in that spirit of interconnection, I'd like to begin by introducing our presenters. Erica Curran is family treatment specialist for the trauma recovery program at the Palo Alto VA. And Erica has been a clinical social worker since 1969. And since 1987, the family treatment specialist for the trauma recovery program at the Palo Alto VA. She's worked with more than 1,500 families whose lives have been impacted by trauma and post-traumatic stress of a family member. This includes families of veterans who served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf, and now active duty members serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. Recently, she has worked with families of active duty personnel who are facing the additional challenges of reunification following multiple deployments in a war zone. I'll also take this opportunity to introduce our second presenter in the second hour, Keith Armstrong. Keith is director of the Family Therapy Clinic and a member of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Clinical Team at the VA in San Francisco, and clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. The co-author of Courage After Fire, a terrific self-help book, which I highly recommend, written for returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their families, Keith is the recipient of numerous teaching awards. It's been my pleasure over the last years to have his wise counsel in the development and growth of the Coming Home Project. There will be an opportunity for questions both from the local audience here in San Francisco and from the audience at a distance watching on Dish TV or online. Please send your email questions to contact@cominghomeproject.net. And we will do our best to get them in. We can't promise, but we'll do our best to get them in. One further point is that if you're interested in the Coming Home Project, you can go to our website, cominghomeproject.net. Without further ado, Erica Curran.
Yeah. I'm okay. I can see the clock. Okay, so thank you for coming today, either if you're here or if you're viewing. Really appreciate interest there is in helping and supporting families of people who are currently serving our country. It's not just those who go to war, but it's their families as well who are making a huge sacrifice. What I'm going to talk about today is what the impact is of war zone deployments on families. And it has to do with the getting ready for somebody to be gone, what happens while somebody's overseas, and what happens as a family tries to work on reunifying after the soldier returns home. When a family comes into your office or a client comes into your office having adjustment problems, having PTSD, when I talk to families and get to know families, that's just the tip of the iceberg for the crushing strain that they've been under, sometimes for many years now, given the multiple deployments. And I think it's important for us to be sensitive to and know what these strains are. I'll talk about assessing and supporting family reintegration and also give you some ideas of resources for families and providers. Just a word about the family therapy models that have informed my practice with families. I've been very, very influenced by the structural model as it was developed by Salvador Mnuchin when he was at the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic. I've been influenced by Jay Haley and Chloe Madonis's work when they worked together at the Family Therapy Institute. And in more recent years, I've come to be more influenced by the narrative therapy approach by Michael White and David Epstein. In particular, their concept of externalizing the problem so people don't feel that the problem is within them, but the problem is something that's happening to them. And that concept alone for families can be very soothing. Sometimes families come to me blaming themselves, blaming each other. It must be my fault. I think it's her fault. It's not their fault. It's what they've been through and what's being asked of them that's really to blame. So Mnuchin based his model on certain concepts. I'm going to tell you what they are, and then for each of these concepts, I'm going to come back and talk about how deployments have impacted these parts of family life. One of the things I look at is proximity between family members. How close are families? How distant are family members from each other? Hierarchy. Are parents working together? Are they in charge of their family together? Are they a parenting team? System-subsystem boundaries. Do those who are in the family recognize that family membership? Are they recognized as a family by folks outside of their immediate family? Coalitions, who's aligned with whom within the family or outside the family. Repeating interaction sequences, what patterns do families go through over and over again over time that become kind of the organizing parts of their lives? And as I talk about each of these elements as they're affected by deployments, with deployments, every single one of these elements shifts, not only shifts once, but shifts again and again and again with multiple deployments. A family I worked with just in the last few weeks, husband and father is career military. He and his wife have three children. He's had 12 deployments at this point. Not all of them have been to war zones, but the most recent was to a war zone. As a family, they were able to really adapt well. They're a really strong family, adapt well to the back and forth in their family life until his most recent deployment. During that deployment, he experienced a trauma unlike anything he'd experienced during other deployments, and that triggered the PTSD, and the family has been derailed since then. So what it's like for families at home when they have a loved one far away. The best resource that I'm familiar with, besides talking to the families, of course, is a book, While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front, written by Kristen Henderson. She is herself the wife of a Marine chaplain who served in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And she talks about not only her own experience, but the experience of many other families who she interviewed and knows personally from her own military experience. What she talks about in that book, I'm just going to give a small tidbit of it, is families being very worried, lonely, overwhelmed by parenting responsibilities, frightened by news reports that are around them all the time, extremely busy, often financially strapped, wondering whose house the car is coming to. And I want to mention this in particular, that she talks about in her book, she's one woman says her experience was that living in a community, a military community, people are kind of on the lookout for a car coming down the road that's going to have officers. And that car is likely coming to someone's house to let them know a family member was killed or injured. So the woman that I'm speaking of right now, the officers would come and pick her up so that she could go along and be an extra comfort to the family. And one day this car came, pulled into her driveway, not to pick her up, but to tell her husband had been killed. And just the communities that live with this day in and day out, it's just enormously stressful. The other thing has to do with communication between families that she talks about. I've worked with some families who've had lots of communication during deployments, families that tell me they talked every day on the phone. It's unheard of in other war zone situations. But I've also talked with families or worked with families where there's been very little communication. Two families I worked with had no communication for 5 months while the family member was deployed. And the reason that in this case, it was the husband gave to his wife for this is he had responsibility for other lives in Iraq, and he felt if his attention was diverted in any way, he was putting people at risk, so chose not to have that contact. So what happens with proximity, closeness between family members? Obviously, there's a huge disengagement, what Mnuchin would call disengagement, distance, while family members deployed. Family members are deploying now for 16 months at a time. That's a long time for partners to be away from each other, a long time for children to have their mom or dad be away. When a family member gets back, there can be some continued disengagement if the person coming back does not fully reintegrate back into the family. And if there's PTSD, the PTSD not being able to integrate fully back into the family can worsen the PTSD, and PTSD can also contribute to not fully reintegrating. So it's really a dual thing that's going on. Each can make the other worse, and I think the extent to which we can support families, support that reintegration, we can maybe protect some from the worsening of the PTSD or the damage that can be done with the PTSD. So the other thing having to do with proximity, because I wasn't sure where to put this, but it does have to do with closeness, is the internet. And if you're a clinician and you're over 25, brace yourselves. These young families are coming with a lot of issues having to do with the internet communication that happens, in particular things that happen over MySpace or Facebook. I would say probably about a quarter of the families I've worked with have issues related to communications that have happened that are sometimes known to the partner, sometimes not. When it's discovered by the partner, it's usually a big problem. So speaking of the internet, a Doonesbury cartoon, Gary Trudeau is a huge supporter of veterans and active duty personnel and the Fisher House. And he has run a series of strips having to do with a lot of different aspects of veterans, healthcare, but two that I'm going to include have to do with deployments and communication that can now happen through, I think it's called Skype, where the person can be at home looking in the computer and the person can see them. So in this particular strip, the wife is at home saying, "Where have you been, Ray? You had me worried sick." And he says, "Sorry, May." And she says, "The whole family is going crazy." And he says, "You told everyone? Great. Now I'll have 30 emails to answer." And she says, "Well, you said you'd be back by 0600. He says, "May, at 0600, I was in the middle of a firefight." She says, "Would it have killed you to text message me?" And he says, "That's what I was thinking, yes." So it brings the war home, and it brings home into the battlefield in a way that we've never, ever seen before. And one of the most touching comments I've heard is actually on a video that I'm going to talk about in a little bit that's been made for teenagers, of teenagers who are talking about their experience with mom or dad being away. And this one teenage girl, she's probably 12, 13, says what she was really worried about is that she would be talking to her dad through the computer, she would see him, and there would be an explosion, and he would get killed right in front of her. And for a child to have this kind of worry is incomprehensible. Had been incomprehensible to me. It never occurred to me that that could be something that would worry a child. And it can be devastating. hierarchy, obviously the parents aren't working together. But when I've talked to parents about, did it ever feel like you were a single parent? Some mothers have told me, no, we talked every day on the phone. There wasn't a decision that I felt that I made on my own. We were always working together. But obviously the hands-on responsibility is with the person at home. And after returning home, the family needs to shift the parenting roles so that they're once again a parenting team. I've seen two extremes that this can take. One would be for the returning family member to come home and say, wow, things have changed here. My wife seems to have everything under control. I don't even know the kids so well anymore. I better just kind of let things go. That's the one extreme. The other extreme is a person that comes home and the parent who has been doing all this parenting for up to 16 months says, okay, you take them now because I'm just too overwhelmed. Either extreme isn't going to work in the long run. I think what families need is support for an understanding that it's a gradual process of moving towards co-parenting together. Or some families, both parents might have deployed. And then who's been helping, how they come back to managing their own family themselves. In terms of hierarchy, relationships between parents and kids, another aspect to what's happening now is the young adult returnee and his interactions with his own family of origin, with his own parents. And if the young adult has PTSD, TBI, or often we see a combination of the two, their relationship with their parents can shift in that here they'd been an autonomous adult now needing more support from their parents and can become developmentally younger. So my role with that family would be how can I support that young person's continuing autonomy at the same time that they do need a little bit more help than they might ordinarily need. Another part of my work has been helping families talk about how parents have coped with deployment. So it's not only the young person talking about what it was like to be away, but them talking about what it was like for mom and dad. And one example that always comes to mind for me is a father who said in a family session, when I went to Afghanistan, my son went to Afghanistan, I white-knuckled it. When he went to Iraq, I drank every single day he was there. And just that speaks to the strain and the, how does one cope with knowing a son or daughter is in danger. Boundaries having to do with knowing who's in the family, that integrity to that family membership is compromised during deployment because one family is not only away but in danger. There's that double compromise, not knowing if they'll come back. The parent or spouse left at home might look outside the family for the support that they need, especially with all the strain they're under. And we know that relationships can start outside of the marriage. There can be affairs. And as a clinician, I want to be real careful, and I want to caution us all to be real careful about not blaming the victim in this case. If there are relationships outside of the family and the family needs to work on reestablishing that boundary, I just want to be aware that as a society, we've created that vulnerability there. It's not the individual person's, that responsibility shouldn't all fall on that one individual's shoulders. The next challenge in terms of boundary is making room for the returning family member. How do they come back into the family system? And I'm going to detour slightly here to talk about adolescence. There was an article, Parental Deployment and Youth in Military Families. And they interviewed teens who were at a camp that was put on by the National Military Family Association, and they did in-depth interviews with these teenagers. And there's lots of quotes in these articles. I'm going to that'll be in the next slide. First, I'm going to say that what they found with these teenagers is that the teens were reporting experiencing a lot of uncertainty, a lot of changes, a lot of problems. The problems that they were reporting were depression, acting out, poor academic performance, increased irritability, and impulsiveness. And the author suggests that what's helpful for teens is to have them be in groups together to be talking about it because they had such similar experiences and can understand and support each other. Keith and I would also add to that recommendation to support the whole family, of course, to work with the parent who's still home and the children. And when the other parent returns home to support that family system as well. But the quotes I want to mention, because it's out of the mouth of babes, no offense to teenagers, because teenagers obviously aren't babes, but still young people can articulate so beautifully what the family struggles with. One teenager said it was a lot harder for us to get back into the routine of having him back than it was for him to leave. Another teen says, and so it's just like, okay, what do we do now? We can't go back to being who we were because we're not that anymore. We have to move forward, but it's also something you have to do as a family. For a teenager to articulate that so precisely is amazing to me. And this is really speaks to the struggle family members have, not only the teens, but mom and dad as well. With children, with teenagers, what can be particularly trying is this kind of scenario that Gary Trudeau captured in this cartoon. Father in Iraq, same father, talking to his stepson. Stepson says, "Yo, step pops, Desmond here." Stepson then says, "Not checking in is not cool, man. Mom spent the evening thinking she'd never see you again. And I was freaking too, man. There's all this stuff we never dealt with, questions I never asked you. Like, if you get smoked, who gets your wheels?" And dad's saying, "I hate this kid." So just because there's deployments and all this strain doesn't mean teenagers aren't teenagers. And that can be tumultuous for families even without deployments, without wars, without the militaries, and it can be heightened with the military. One family I worked with, the father, as he was leaving for Iraq, as he left the house to go to Iraq, his 13-year-old stepson said, "I hope you get killed over there." So he comes back, comes into our treatment program 4 years later, and is still very impacted by this remark that his stepson made. Stepson's now 17, might even not remember having said it. I mean, how many older teens remember what they say when they're angry at parents when they're younger? But for this father, it was just something he couldn't get past. And what he presented as a main issue for him is that this stepson had not invited him to his high school graduation. And he said, "But he hasn't invited me." And I was doing a conference call with this man and his wife. And the wife said, "Well, you're in the family. The whole family's invited." Well, that isn't what this stepfather needed. So his wife got the son to come onto the phone. And the son, now 17, said, "Hey, Dad, I'd really like you to come to my high school graduation." And this father had tears streaming down his face when he heard that invitation. And that's what he needed to heal from that breach there had been between him and his stepson. I just want to mention other things that are particularly trying for parents is intrusive thoughts that have to do with events in a war zone that involve children. For parents who have children, one father in particular said that he was in an event in Iraq where children had been killed. His nightmares, intrusive thoughts about that event, now those children have his children's faces on those images, and just not being able to be with his children without thinking about that, or just the terror of having nightmares about his own children dying. The last thing I want to mention having to do with trying for parents is we know from the Vietnam vets that when they had babies, their babies crying was very, very uncomfortable, very triggering for them. And we're hearing the same thing from parents coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, that babies crying is very triggering. And I do the parenting group in the program, and one of the things I talk about is that all parents struggle with babies crying. It's stressful for any parent. With PTSD, that stress is more severe. And I want to be sure to provide these families with information about how to cope with babies crying. And there's a lot out there on the internet that is not only can be normalizing, yes, this is stressful for all parents, but also has some ideas for how to help soothe a baby or how to take care of your own stress related to that. So if you're working with families with young babies or young children, I'd encourage you to check that out. Coalitions, who's aligned with whom? The coalitions are very likely to shift during deployment. The parent at home is going to be closer to the children. Proximity, just being together day after day. Who's been co-parenting? One returnee was initially he was very disturbed by his father-in-law having become so close to his son. His father-in-law, by the way, is a Vietnam vet who realized that when his son-in-law was at war, he wanted to be closer to the family, and he and his wife had actually moved to be closer to the family. And so the father comes back from Iraq, wonders, is there still a spot for me in the family? But came to understand that his father-in-law offered something to his son that his son otherwise would not have had in his absence. So he became very appreciative of that. And that's part of kind of coming back into and reintegrating into the family, seeing it in that way as something that's a support rather than something that taking away from him. Coalitions will need to be realigned in terms of mom or dad coming back, becoming close once again, but then for how long before there's going to be that separation again? There's also, and we've seen this happen among Vietnam vets, that there can be a closeness with fellow combatants that has an intimacy, a power to it that isn't even part of most marriages. And so likewise, if somebody has had involvements outside the family that needs to be come back into the family, likewise, a person coming back needs to challenge their allegiance and make sure they're connecting with their family as well as fellow combatants. One of the saddest families I worked with over the years was a woman who, she and her husband had been married for 30-some years, and she said to me, my husband can go out and have breakfast every morning with another Vietnam vet, and they can talk for 2 hours, and when he comes home, he has nothing to say to me, and hasn't for years. That my work with that family was around what can this couple talk about together. Repeating interaction sequences, so those patterns that families get into just naturally are going to change and need to change again when a person comes home, either reintegrating back into family patterns or sometimes finding that changes have made the old pattern, the old sequences obsolete. I mean, if there's a new baby in the family when somebody gets home, there's not going to be a return to the way it had been. There can't and shouldn't be, but developing new sequences. And I've worked with some young couples who've had more time apart than time together. Some of them have never had a chance to get into some patterns together. So what can they put together between deployments that's going to serve what they need? Or if the person is home for good, if the person is a veteran at this point, how to establish their new family patterns, given that they started off in such a rough way. And of course, all these dynamics, if there's going to be redeployments, the issue becomes how to make the most of the time that they do have together, supporting that, and then realizing and just kind of validating for them how stressful it is that it's going to start all over again and again and again and again for some families. It's not unusual for me at this point to be working with families that have had 3-4 deployments. So families who come to my office, families who come to see you, can be in a variety of different life stages. I've worked with lots of couples who are in very long-term stable relationships, up to 50-some years of marriage with World War II wet families. I've worked with couples who are in more recent, obviously, marriages or relationships, can be first for her, second for him, any kind of combination of numbers you can think of could come to you. Couples just entering relationships, the briefest relationship I've worked with is a couple who met on the internet a month before the man came into our program. They met in person 3 weeks before he came in, and they got engaged a week before he came into the program. And I worked with this couple. She lived with his mother while he was in our program, and it was a very early relationship work, obviously. Some of the work with folks that get right out of school, go into the military, have these deployments, come back home, starting relationships. It's almost like working with older teens about relationship building skills. And what were your dreams about how you wanted to be together as a family, rather than how has it been for you as a family? Because they don't know. They haven't had that. My work now includes more of working with veterans, their parents, and or siblings, and making sure I do whatever I can to support that continuing relationship between returnees and their parents. I've worked with many Vietnam vets who, when they came back from Vietnam, had become disengaged from their families and come into our program not having seen their parents for 20 years, not knowing where their siblings are. I want to do what I can to to facilitate and support that contact, that family membership. One mother and son I worked with, I worked with the young man and his wife, and she lived in another state, and then the mother flew up, stayed at Fisher House for a couple of days, and I had some sessions with the mother and son, and the son was saying to the mother, you know, I need to be part of the family, I need to know what's happening. And the mother said, well, you've had the TBI, sometimes you have seizures, and I don't want to say anything that's upsetting to you, I want to protect you. And he's saying, you know, that doesn't help me be part of the family. And I said to the mother, is there anything now that he needs to know? And I need to tell you that 10 minutes before I asked this question, they were talking about his older sister and how thrilled the whole family was that the sister was pregnant. She was the only child not to have children in this family, and everybody was so happy for her. And when I said to the mother, is there anything he needs to know, she hesitated for a long time and turned to him and said, your sister had a miscarriage last week. He had not known this. So he looked down, a long pause, and he looked back at his mom and he said, you know, that's what I mean. I need to know these things. If I don't know these things, I can't be part of the family. And after our session, he went and he called his sister and offered his condolences and support for the loss of that pregnancy. I can just imagine how out of sync it would have been for him to, the next time he talked to her, not know the miscarriage and express his joy and enthusiasm for this pregnancy again. And this is how I felt like I was really at the crossroads of this family, either coming back together or having more distance. And if you can watch for those moments and help with that connection, I think we'll be doing a great service. And families, I've already said, have had up to 12 deployments. I changed that slide recently. That slide used to say 5 deployments, but it's having worked recently with a family with 12 deployments. And this is the career military that people have been away from home so much, and couples who have been apart more than together. So if a family comes into residential rehab, that's how I meet families because that's the program that I work in. The one thing I ask every single family the first time I talk with them is, what do you want as a family to come from so-and-so being in treatment? I say usually when somebody's in treatment, it's about wanting to make some changes. Have the two of you had a chance to talk about what you want that to mean for you, your relationship, and your family? And sometimes they have, but more often they haven't talked about that because they've been kind of preoccupied with this individual having problems and getting the help. So I want to know from them, what do they want as a family? And as they start to talk to me about that, I'll say, how will you know when this is happening, the changes that you want? And sometimes I need to ask this third question, but often they just evolve into talking about what they're already noticing in the direction of the changes they want. When the family gives me the information about what they want as a family to come from this, how they'll know, what changes they're noticing, that lays out for me the content of the therapy. That's what we're going to talk about. That's what I'm going to help that family to work towards. I'm not going to talk to them about the structural model. I'm not going to talk to them about proximity hierarchy, but I'm going to keep those concepts in mind as I help them to achieve what they want as a family. If I were doing outpatient work, this is what I'm pretty sure I would ask families when they came to see me. How will you know when things are going better for you as a family? What will you be noticing is different? Can you think of a time that this has happened in your family life together? For people who've had a few years under their belts, their marriage belts before the deployments, there often is a time, well, you know, back when the way it used to be. But for young couples, that's when I need to ask, how did you want to be together as a family when you first started talking about being together? Because I want to tap into the dreams they have without realizing they haven't had an opportunity to fulfill them. So what I want to do with families, what my goals are, based in the content, again, is going to be around what they tell me their goals are. But my goal is going to be to support the integrity of the family unit as they work towards these goals. I'm going to pay attention to the proximity, hierarchy, boundaries, coalitions, interaction sequences. I want to support positive coping of family members. I want to highlight competencies and strengths of all family members, and in particular with parents. parents. I want to help them to be and feel conscious to offer their children and kind of lose awareness that just being home is so much to offer to their children. And I really want to highlight what they are bringing to their family and less, of course, but not highlighting that. So things to look for in terms of assessing families for how they're doing with the reunification back to being a family again. One of the things that will be available on the website that goes along with this presentation is a questionnaire I developed years ago. You're welcome to use this questionnaire in any way that could work for you. Some people might choose to actually ask families to complete the questionnaire. You might want to just use it to acquaint yourself with the kind of questions that can be useful for a family for you to ask. Any one of these topics could be conversations to do with a group of couples or group of families, just by saying, you know, sometimes families struggle with this. How's this been for everybody in the group? So anyway, these ideas would be useful. I'd encourage you to use them. One question is, had the family been able to resume routines or develop equally satisfying new ones? And if they say no or not so much, I want to know what's still missing. And what's still missing for them is what I'll want to help them to achieve and get back to. Did the returning family member miss any significant family events? If so, how can those events be recognized and honored? So what's in italics is not part of the questionnaire. What's in italics is just what I would want to bring to however they answer that question. So one father and mother, three young children, he'd had three deployments in Iraq, came back from the third one more withdrawn than he'd ever been before. And his wife thought, well, he's depressed, he's withdrawn. We all know isolation can be part of PTSD. And he said, well, you know what? It's not so much any of those things. It's that when I go out with the children now, I don't feel like I can keep them safe. And that hypervigilance that the Vietnam vets have told us about is a very present issue for a lot of young parents, just that fear about keeping their children safe. But the part I want to say in terms of missing significant family events is that this man, he'd coincidentally been present for the birth of all three children, and just as coincidentally had missed every single birthday with every child. And this family came down from Alaska, stayed at Fisher House, were involved in some family therapy. And one of the things they did while they were there is that mom and dad took the three kids out to a Chunk E. Cheese, had a birthday party. Birthday cake, balloons, candles, singing happy birthday, the whole deal. Which is great for the kids because they get to have dad witnessing and enjoying that with them. But great for the dad, too, who's missed all those birthdays, that he gets to sing happy birthday to his kids. Another question, did the family put anything on hold during the family member's absence that now needs attention? And depending on the answer, I might ask about decisions postponed. Have there been changes? Have there been moves? When I asked one couple this question, it was National Guard who's been activated in his 50s. He and his wife were 15 years married, both now have grown children, altogether five children. He'd been activated 13 months tours, home 4 months, another 13-month tour. I think it was 13, it was very close to 13 or maybe 14. Came back home withdrawn, argumentative, irritable, not able to be with his children, be with his grandchildren. That's one couple when I first did a call with them. He said, you know, I think it's my fault. I think I'm just fighting a lot and it's my fault that we're having problems in our marriage. And she says, you know, I think it might be my fault. So there again, the blaming each other. But in response to this question, what the husband said is he said, our daughter, and it was the wife's biological daughter, died a month before our first deployment and we've never had a chance to grieve together. And this is exactly what the therapy needed to be about, this loss of an adult daughter after a 10-year extremely painful, difficult illness with cancer. And it's wife thinking, well, he didn't experience the loss like I do, when, as we talked about it, he clearly had in just many sessions. Three sessions were mostly about that loss of the daughter, and that family also started going to a local community support group for parents who've lost children. I just want to remember to say that there are a lot of community supports out there. I work at the VA. Keith works at the VA, too. I tend to focus most on what's available at the VA, but it's very important to access local supports. The one thing, I'll say one more thing about this family, because one of the ways that they were expressing that being stuck around the loss of the daughter is that the wife was still using this deceased daughter's cell phone and still had this daughter's voice answering message on the phone. And so there's a breakdown in communication between the husband and wife, and then the husband was able to say to his wife, you know, when that phone rings more than three times, I hang up because it's so painful for me to hear her voice. So that was contributing to, on top of everything else, the breakdown in communication. So again, wherever the family leads me is where I want to help them to work on. Have the partners eased back into making decisions together? Is a returning partner have a voice in decision? Has the partner at home invited inclusion? Or has the partner at home felt like, well, they're under so much stress, I better take care of this myself? Or the partner returning, boy, you know, she or he has this all figured out. You know, maybe it's the finances, maybe it's things with the kids, maybe it's extended family, any number of things. It can help if there's an invitation from the person at home saying, you know I've handled this on my own, but I'd really like us to get back to doing it as a team. Sometimes being reluctant to ask for that because of how stressed the person is. So just kind of supporting a family in moving together and doing these things. Have there been times when the returning family member gives the impression that he or she wants to be left alone? And of course, that's looking for what there might be happening around PTSD. Is the returnee feeling like a bit of an outsider to the family? If so, what would help him or her feel more included? What would help him or her feel more at ease with being more involved with the family? As a couple, are partners closer or more distant than before? Has there been tension, disagreement, or conflict? And if so, and if that's been high tension, high conflict, that might be the place to start with that family. If there's severe conflict, tension, assessment for safety and safety plan for that family. Has anyone who helped the family out still feel like they're more a part of the family than the couple would ordinarily want them to be? And if that's the case, especially for young couples, they can benefit from some coaching about how to negotiate with the family about that, or how to communicate with the family about that. Young people can say to parents, we sure appreciate you having helped us out while so-and-so was away. We're really glad and relieved to be back together again so we can take care of our family ourselves. It feels great to know that we can always turn to you if we need help again. So it's securing that privacy back for the family again in a way that expresses some gratitude and a request for respect for privacy at the same time that they might need to reach out again to people. Very complicated for anybody to figure out, let alone real young folks who might not have a life experience to do this. Is a returning parent feeling acting more protective in the family? And I talked about that a little bit. Has the family had a chance to talk about their worries while the family member was in the war? And sometimes people are reluctant to bring it up because of the worries were so hard or the memories are so hard. But I think it's important that parents model for their children that it's okay to talk about the worries. And if their children are kind of shy about asking, that the parents ask them directly. Well, you know, what was it like for you? One of the things that's also on the website is a coloring book that an intern who was with me a couple years ago, she drew the pictures, has the captions on the pages, and she and I co-authored the last few pages, which are for each page what a family, a parent can ask a child to talk about. That can be an icebreaker for parents and kids to use that. Or if a family's in your office, there's one particular issue, print out one page and have the family gather around and color that and talk about it. Has a returning family member been able to talk with others, answer questions about their war experiences? And I think that it is important for some discussion to be supported, to decrease the potential for estrangement for the person coming back, and to support a context for understanding changed behaviors that the family is aware of. If returning home for good, one question I have is, how will you all know that the person coming back is really home? And it can be useful for adults and kids to talk about ways that they already know that mom or dad is home, or and also what else needs to happen for the reunion to feel more complete. Now, the question more needs to be how to make the most of the time they have together, because there are very few people that are home now know they're home for good, unless they're already separated from the service and in the veteran population, in which case, of course, you can ask, how do you know the person's really home? But I wouldn't want to ask that question when somebody's going to go away again. So I expect that a lot of people who are listening today or watching today might not know how do I get in touch with the VA for somebody that I'm working with. There's a webpage, the VA medical system has a webpage. It's at www.va.gov. On the left-hand corner, there's some options to select from. You select healthcare. A window will pop out that says facility locator. Go to the facility locator and enter the family zip code. And what's going to come up for you is all the nearby medical centers, VA outpatient clinics and vet centers. See what's closest to the family. Click on that link and it'll take you to the page for that vet center with the address, the staff names, the phone numbers. You can print that out and hand it to the family that's in your office. So a handy way to get to the information if you know how to do it. Resources for families, obviously VA medical centers, outpatient clinics, vet centers. I just want to mention that vet centers have had a particularly difficult mission given to them by Congress to work with families who have lost a family member over in the war zone. Very hard work to do. The vet center counselors are out there doing it, and I give them all the credit in the world for the work that they do. Other resources, Military OneSource, fabulous resource. Go to their website, all kinds of things for families. National Resource Directory is a brand new thing. It came to my attention. I think it was just announced publicly 2 weeks ago. Again, a lot of resources for families. I want to mention the National Military Family Association in particular because they have summer camps for kids. And if a family goes to their website, there's going to be a map. The family clicks on what state they live in, and it comes up a list of where the camps are, what ages they're for, what the dates are for those camps. And they're free to military, active duty military kids and families. So it's not too soon, I would think, to go in and encourage families to start looking for next summer. The National Center for PTSD has more resources about PTSD than three people could read in a lifetime. If you're interested in families in particular, just put that in the browser, families, and those resources will show up. The best resource, and it's a booklet put together by the Canadian VA, best resource for families with young kids is PTSD in the Family for parents of young children. And if you have parents who are wondering about what's this mean for our kids, I would encourage them to go there. New videos that are out are absolutely fabulous. Sesame Street has a three-part series, one having to do with deployments, one on homecoming, one for changes. For each of these segments, there's a corresponding for parents only video. So those of you who are familiar with Sesame Street might know Elmo. Elmo's dad deploys. And it doesn't talk about deploying to a war zone. It talks about dad's going to be away for a while. And then dad comes back home and what it's like for everybody for those changes to happen. For elementary age kids, the military and the American Pediatric Association got together and created this animated video, Mr. Poe and Friends Discuss Family Reunion After Deployment. So Mr. Poe is at the airport with a couple of his friends waiting for a plane to come back. And while they're waiting, he goes around to different kinds of family groups waiting for a family member to come back. And he interviews them about, well, what was it like for your brother to be gone? Or what was it like for your mom to be gone? And just a wonderful, again, conversation starter. And I already mentioned the military youth coping with separation when a family member deploys was created for teenagers. The only people you hear speaking on this video are teenagers talking about different aspects of having a parent deployed. All these videos are available to active duty personnel through Military OneSource. If you are a provider working with active duty, National Guard, National Reserve, regardless of activation status, call Military OneSource and say that you're working with families, and they'll send you these videos you can use in your practice. I've used the Sesame Street video several times now with families, and it's very valuable, especially for young kids who don't have an easy way to talk about it. But boy, they sure know what it's like for Elmo and Elmo's friends, and then talking about what it's like for them. Also available online, So at the site for this presentation is this PowerPoint that you just heard. There's a bibliography of books for families. There's a bibliography of websites for families. Feel free to duplicate it, hand it out in any way it can be useful for you. The coloring book I mentioned by Deborah Butler, social worker, and the transitioning family questionnaire. And I think I'm right on time, right? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, I don't know how. Okay.
Thank you very much, Erica, for that wonderful presentation.
Sorry.
We have a few minutes for questions. We have one question from someone who emailed us in, and I would imagine that you folks in the live audience might as well. However, I would like to begin by asking Erica to speak just briefly about, I think, a very important matter, and that's the matter of intimacy and sexuality in couples. I think it's an issue that doesn't get addressed very much. Could you say anything about that, the issues upon reintegration?
Yes, well, there are a couple things having to do with working in a residential program. One, well, this actually isn't necessarily residential, but just coming back as a family again, expectations people might have, but some awkwardness about initiating or disappointment about what does happen or doesn't happen. And I think couples need support in knowing it's okay to talk about, and this, we can talk about it, and we can talk about how it can be more comfortable for you. I think when there's been military sexual trauma, it's particularly important to be ready to talk with a couple about, because intimacy between a couple can become very triggering because of the closeness to replicating the trauma. And I think it's very important for a couple in that situation to talk about what's comfortable. In residential rehab, when somebody has PTSD, coming into a program, there's one of the things we know can be helpful for PTSD is medications. We know medications have side effects. For couples to understand, first of all, know that some of, if they're experiencing some problems, some of it might be related to medications. And I always want to encourage the person who's on the medications to speak to their physician and invite the wife to have questions through the physician as well.
I'd like to pose a question from Tracy Rice in Kansas. She asked a number of terrific questions. I'm going to pose two of them to you, Erica. One is, could you say something about the prevalence of divorce in among soldiers who are returning, those families? And if you could say something about support groups out there for spouses in particular.
Okay. So let me answer the second question first. Support groups are becoming more and more available at VAs now, but where a family can always turn for quick support as a family is a vet center system. They've been, for decades, have been there to support families, even before the VA was so inclusive of families. So I think that's the first place I'd look. If I was with a client, I would call the vet center for them and say, does your vet center have a support group for families? And many do, especially now. And the second question was about the divorce?
About divorce.
Yeah.
Families working on reintegration.
Yeah. So I don't have any idea what the numbers would be, but I know that given the strain that families are under and the way I've seen couples get into blaming each other, blaming themselves, if that's the path they're going to go to, that is more likely to eventually lead to divorce than a couple that can come to understand that, hey, it's not us, it's not you, it's not me, it's what we've been through, it's what's happened to us, that can be helpful in terms of helping them see light at the end of the tunnel in terms of, well, maybe things can get better for us.
Are there any people in our live audience who have questions? We do have a few minutes, so please feel free.
I was curious about the sexual relations or intimacy re-triggering or trauma.
If there's been military...
I'll just repeat the question. Yeah, the question was, again, about the possibility of getting back into a routine of sexual intimacy, re-triggering trauma.
Yeah, if the trauma that an individual has experienced that has led to the PTSD is a sexual nature, then that kind of closeness, that kind of intimacy, having sex with a partner can bring up reminders. As we know that people can be triggered by reminders, say somebody's been in a car accident, has PTSD related to a severe car accident, life-threatening. If they pass a car accident on the street, they're likely to have more intrusive thoughts. That's going to come back to them. If somebody's experienced a sexual trauma and then is with a partner and they're sexually together, that could bring back memories. And I think it's important for the couple to understand that any kind of pulling back it's more likely to be a reflection of the trauma than it is a reflection of something wrong with a relationship or some kind of distance a person wants from a partner. We have a women's trauma recovery program is part of the program where I work, and yes, it is part of the population we serve.
Women.
Yeah. And we've also had men in our program who've experienced military sexual trauma as well, which is sometimes harder. My experience has been it's sometimes harder for a man to let his partner know that he experienced military sexual trauma. So that's an issue, too, to work on.
Well, I'd like to thank Erica for her excellent presentation, and please let's show our appreciation. I'm Joseph Bobro, the founder and president of the Coming Home Project, and in the first part, we heard Erica Curran from the Palo Alto VA, and in part two, we're going to hear my friend and colleague and expert in the field, Keith Armstrong from the San Francisco VA. I'd like to say just a little bit about the Coming Home Project. We are a group of psychotherapists, veterans, family members, and interfaith leaders who address the emotional, spiritual, relationship, and reintegration problems faced by Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their families through four different kinds of programs, community forums, education and training, free psychological counseling, and innovative residential retreats for veterans and their families. Our website is cominghomeproject.net. I introduced Keith at the beginning of part one, but for those of you who perhaps are watching this on UCTV program, I'll say again that Keith is director of the Family Therapy Clinic and a member of the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder clinical team at the VA in San Francisco, and clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of San Francisco, California in San Francisco. He's the co-author of a terrific book called Courage After Fire, which I highly recommend. It's a self-help book for returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their families, and also serves as a terrific primer for mental health and other health professionals and practitioners who are working with veterans and their families. And Keith is a recipient of numerous awards, and it's my pleasure to present Keith Armstrong.
Thanks, Joe. It's an honor to be here, and I also want to thank Erica for a wonderful presentation earlier, and thank UCTV for hosting this event. And we have a lot to cover in a short period of time, so let's get to it here. So what I'm going to try to do is cover what I consider the relevant demographics with regard to this population, and then talk a little bit about the clinical presentation of vets and their partners, and then talk about assessing and treating Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their partners. There's a lot of things that I'm not going to be able to address today. So I think I want to just let you know what I'm not going to be able to address as well. So we won't be talking about couples in which a veteran has severe TBI, for instance. Most of my work has been with heterosexual couples where the OEF-OIF veteran is male. I have some experience in working with couples where the vet is female, and some experience in working with couples in which both members are veterans as well. But the focus will be primarily on heterosexual couples where the Iraq or Afghanistan veteran is male. I think the other thing to let you know is that I'm going to be talking some today about integrating principles of emotionally focused couples therapy in my work with OAF, OIF vets. And so my ideas here, some of these ideas are preliminary. They're subject to change in future presentations. Don't quote me for longer than about 10 minutes. So why don't we get started here? So the number of troops that have served in OAF and OIF, this is a typical question that I ask an audience. I won't do that for today's presentation. And usually, if it's an audience of therapists, even in places such as Kansas City, where I recently presented, they underestimate the number significantly. So I don't know if that says what that says about therapists, or I'm not sure what it says. But I think that what happens is if you're not directly affected by this war, then I think it's easy to forget how many people have served, and also to not provide the kind of support that the vets and their families really need. So the number is 1,811,000. And that's have served in either OEF or OIF. And as you can see, over 600,000 people have served more than one tour. And Erica, you know, nicely talked about it, working with vets that have served 4 to 5 tours in Iraq or Afghanistan, and more tours if you include other places that they've served. I think the other thing to remember is that's just the number of people who have served. And those folks, of course, are attached to families. They're attached to parents, to partners, to kids. And so that number gets bigger and bigger. And not to mention cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and friends. So I think this is another stat that is significantly different from the Vietnam generation, which is half of our veterans are married. Now this is very different from what we experienced in Vietnam, where the numbers were much lower than that. So what do vets look like when they come into our treatment program? Well, the view of their world has changed, and they're less connected to peer groups. They have less in common with peer groups. They feel alienated. Sometimes feel spiritually alienated, questioning whether or not there's a God. What we also see a lot of times are family of origin ruptures, work issues sometimes come up, especially with our National Guard Reserve folks. Sometimes we'll notice a much more acute distress. Hypervigilance is significantly increased, and I know that's a hallmark of PTSD, but I think in this population, arousal symptoms of the newly returning veterans I see as being a predominant challenge for them and for the people who are working with them, much more than the intrusive symptoms and the avoidance symptoms. And that's in my estimation. A lot of times people will be feeling like nothing really matters. Why try? There's just not a lot to invest in, and they'll engage in a fair amount of self-destructive, reckless kinds of behavior. So they'll maybe drive the car really fast. You know, as I think that there's a recent couple of recent articles on the number of motorcycle deaths of OEF OIF veterans is very high, and I think that's a way of attempting to recapture the adrenaline and that experienced in wartime, but it ends up, I think, backfiring. And also anger and revenge-based fantasies. You know, it's one thing to think about when you're really angry with somebody, to have an idea of what you'd want to do with them. It's another thing to have actually seen that take place and to really view that as an option. And that can be very frightening to the service member to have those ideas, and it can also be frightening to their family members, especially if they talk about those ideas. So feeling disillusioned or betrayed, some people are really scared to be redeployed. We see folks that do not want to go back. But we've also seen folks who feel it's their obligation to go back, and in fact, they do want to go back because they have friends there who are serving, and they want to help them, and they're very, very connected to those folks. And I think it's something that Erica talked about before. There's a tremendously powerful bond of serving in the armed services, especially in combat, that's very difficult to replicate anywhere else and to really understand unless you've actually had that kind of experience directly. So some folks, you know, have memories or reminders of the war that they that continue to bother them. So intrusive memories. What we found is that this group is reluctant to seek help, and I think that some of that is adaptive in a funny way. They're, you know, especially the younger folks between the ages of 20 and 30 are really trying to get out and live their life, and maybe get employed or go to school, and don't necessarily want to make a commitment to treatment. And I don't think that they've necessarily realized the important connection that treatment can allow them to do these life tasks like work, improve in relationships and school much better. And so sometimes it takes two or three failures, sometimes more failures, before treatment ends up being a place that somebody goes to. I think the most important a point that I want to make that has to do with this slide and the previous slide is, what's the impact on a partner when their loved one is going through these kinds of experiences? And I really want you to think about that, that the partner has to figure out, who is the person I'm with now, and how can we help each other make sense of the war experience that he or she went through. So here's the idealist view of what couples therapy can do. They share the clicker at the remote, right? Doesn't always happen, but occasionally you have a successful case that looks like this. So here, sweetheart, you take the clicker. No thanks, you hold it, darling. No you, right? In terms of what treatments, what we know about good couples therapy treatment, really, there are three studied treatments that currently exist, and two of them are very well researched. The cognitive behavioral therapy model of Jacobson and Christensen, and emotionally focused therapy model of Sue Johnson. And both of those models have had a number of studies that have replicated their positive effects in improving relationships and moving people from feeling dissatisfied in their marriage to feeling satisfied about 70% of the time, which is a pretty impressive number. So what do we know about treating couples in which a member is diagnosed with PTSD? Well, here are some numbers. I think that the bottom line is, not much. There have been a few studies that have been done in addition to the studies that I've listed here, but really only two randomized controlled clinical trials, so an N of 56 total. And this is with Vietnam veterans and their partners. So a couple of the caveats with regard to those studies. One is that you can't necessarily translate the research from the Vietnam veteran population to the OEF-OIF population. That a lot of these studies were done, you know, a number of years, a decade or more after the end of the war, and they are almost all, not all, but many of them are done with relationships that are, you know, where people are on their second or their third relationship. They're also at, I think, a different developmental stage in terms of the age of the population, and I think that that makes a big difference. I think Erica talked a little bit about that in her presentation. And certainly in these models, there are really inconsistent number of therapy sessions, and the length of each therapy session varied for these studies. So they've varied anywhere from 60 minutes to 2 hours in length, and the number of sessions, I think, varied from about 8 sessions to, I think around 15 to 20 sessions. So it's hard to draw any conclusions. What the data did say was that it appears that that marital therapy, at least in a couple of the studies, looks like it's useful. It helps to increase, in some studies, helps to increase marital satisfaction. In other studies, only help to decrease PTSD symptoms. But I think in either case, that those aren't bad findings. But again, they're very preliminary, and they're with a slightly different population than who we're talking about now. Currently, there are a couple of studies that are happening in the United States. One is in Boston by Candace Monson, and it's a cognitive behavioral couples therapy study. And in that study, it's a study that's open to veterans and non-vets. And one member has to meet the criteria for a diagnosis of PTSD. In the other study, it's an emotionally focused therapy study that Neil Weissman is doing in Baltimore. And in that study is only for veterans, in which one of the members meets the criteria for PTSD. I haven't spoken with Candace about her study. Neil's study is progressing nicely, and you know he says he's getting good results. So it'll be interesting to kind of hear more as that comes along. I think that the couple things to be thinking about, though, if you're a couples therapist, is what are you doing when you work with a couple? Are you treating the relationship? Are you treating the PTSD symptoms? Are you trying to treat both? And my thinking about that is to first and foremost treat the relationship, and through treating the relationship, the PTSD symptoms may improve. Now, other people will be trying to address specifically the PTSD symptoms, and through improving the PTSD symptoms, the relationship improves. But I prefer to tackle relationships by improving relationships first, and then, generally speaking, the symptoms tend to dissipate. So, what I wanted to do was talk a little bit here about what's the presentation of the couples that we see, and I think it's important to note that it's a variety of presentations, right? It's not a cookie cutter. When the couples come in, it isn't sort of a cookie cutter model. That there are a lot of different aspects that that affect kind of how they look. So, some of the things that are important to pay attention to are any kind of pre-morbid mental health problems that either member of the couple has, the severity of the war-related psychiatric symptoms that the veteran comes in with, so how symptomatic is the veteran, any history of trauma or in either member of the couple, and what we've noticed, and I imagine Erica might comment on this as well at some point. I think she'd probably agree with this. Is that for couples who have established themselves, especially this is for the couples that we've worked with from Vietnam that are on their, you know, the veteran maybe on his third or fourth marriage, that a lot of times the folks that they end up marrying are folks that have had their own interpersonal trauma histories as well. And in a way, there's a common bond that gets created that makes some issues more difficult to work on, but other issues easier to work on, because there's sort of an understanding about what the effects of trauma is for the couple. Other issues, the developmental stage that the couple is in, so how new is this relationship? And of course, what's the developmental stage of each individual within the relationship? Those are, I think, important factors. And obviously, relationship satisfaction, we know, is important. That that a lot of times when couples present, it's typically, you know, from the at least the behavioral marital therapy literature, it's usually 6 years after being in distress that couples walk into the couples therapy office. We're hoping to get people in, you know, earlier, and we have gotten some folks in earlier from this war, but usually couples come in a fair amount of distress, and the lower the distress, in my estimation, the more challenging the work, or I should say the lower the satisfaction, the more challenging the work. Sorry about that. The other thing is to really focus on is the numbing versus arousal. Now, if you look at the data from Vietnam veterans and their families and other studies that have been done, that the symptom cluster that appears to be most difficult to treat and to work with are the numbing symptoms. So feeling unable to get close to your partner, and your partner feeling like, you know, that they're emotionally dead inside and that nothing matters, is a brutal symptom to have to deal with for a couple. because you know, I want to get close to him, but I can't. I'm not sure if I matter to him. I don't know what I feel inside. So these are common comments that couples make. And when we see this, it's typically, my experience is, it's typically in older couples that have settled in, that have had PTSD for a long time and have settled into particular relationship patterns that become more challenging to treat. With the younger couples who have been together less as long a period of time, I find that the arousal symptoms are much more problematic. So I don't know when he's going to get upset. It freaks me out. I'm afraid to go near him. I don't want to sleep next to him because when he thrashes around with nightmares, sometimes he hits me. And I'm not saying that those issues aren't there in the older couples, but I think that they're less problematic than the numbing symptoms. Whereas in the younger couples, it's the arousal symptoms, it's getting into fights, drinking, those kinds of issues that I think cause more difficulties in relationships. So, you know, it's interesting. In the couples world, at the VA and working in the field of trauma, I think that sometimes that we're the first stop that people, you know, come in to get help around. So a lot of times vets will come in to get help because their family member drags them in. They're, well, my wife says we've got some problems, so, you know, let's go get some help. And so sometimes the couples program will be the first place that they'll come in to get help, and then we can provide them help in addition to couples therapy if they so choose. Other times it's the last place that they'll go to. So they'll have tried a number of other things before they come, and it's really a last-ditch effort prior to divorce. And so the stakes can be extremely high in the work. The issues that the couples are working on, the OEF-OIF couples are working on, are very similar to issues that couples in a regular therapy practice work on. So are issues, you know, about money and jealousy, sex, affairs, in-laws, household chores, etc. I think the issue of going out is a bit different. And I remember working with one couple, a young OEF-OIF couple, and we were talking about the difficulty that they had in going out to a restaurant. And what had happened was that while they were at this restaurant, which was supposed to be an enjoyable evening in the South of Market here in San Francisco, the veteran got triggered by some smells with regard to the food. And so he started having really bad intrusive memories of his time in Iraq. And instead of telling his partner what was going on, he tried to tough it out because he didn't want her to have a bad time. But when she noticed that something was wrong and she asked about it, he started snapping at her. And so she was very puzzled about what was going on and didn't handle it in the perfect way that one would handle it, you know, which is when somebody snaps at you, sometimes you snap back, right? And what ended up happening is they ended up getting out of the restaurant quickly and talking about what happened and coming to the office to finish up that conversation about what was going on. And I think that in the conversation, we were talking about ways they could, you know, figure out, signals to give each other if there's any kind of a problem when they're in a crowded restaurant, ways to make it a little more comfortable, a little more safe. But the issue that really set a light bulb off in the partner's head was, well, wait a second. Does this mean I can't go out anymore with you? What does this mean? Because because going out is supposed to be fun. And if this isn't going to be fun, then why are we doing it? But I want to go out. And, you know, as I say jokingly that, you know, when you get to be my age, you don't really care about going out a whole lot. You just kind of go and you go and hang out at home. But when you're young, you go out. And to have that taken away is not simple. It's not very simple to do. And so figuring out a strategy around how they can negotiate going out, maybe in a place that has less stimulation, so that the needs of being able to go out and have some sort of a nightlife can get satisfied. At the same time, being respectful of the severe symptoms that her partner is experiencing is, you know, an area of negotiation that the couple had. So having additional relationships, I think Erica mentioned a little bit about this in her presentation, the idea of being very protective of family members and who they associate with, and worrying whether or not they're going to get hurt or whether or not the veteran's going to be betrayed, is a huge issue in couples that I've seen. I think that you'll also see issues where the partner, you know, is very interested in figuring out how to help and how to really be supportive for their veteran, and sometimes this can be incredibly useful. The danger, though, is that the partner ends up only being supportive to the vet without the vet being able to take that same role with the partner. And this is a crucial issue that one needs to negotiate with couples to make sure that the veteran is able to provide the same kind of support back to the partner, whatever the issues are. So again, which relationships are we talking about? Are we talking about relationships where people met beforehand and had a relationship prior to deployment? They might have had kids. Are we talking about little to no history of relationship? They don't really know each other before war. So there are people that have, you know, get married after a very, very brief relationship and then get deployed. And they can do that for a lot of reasons, some because they're in love, some because, you know, there are some practically advantageous reasons about being married for their partner. So it runs the gamut in terms of the relationships that we're really talking about. And so getting a good relationship history when you're working with couples is absolutely crucial. Obviously, there are also folks, you know, that meet after war. So with the partners, we know that arousal is heightened in OEF-OIF vets. We find that impulsivity is more prominent. There's a fair amount of substance use, and that's from Red Bull onto the illicit substances, so methamphetamine use, marijuana, and of course alcohol. I think that what I found is that the younger relationships, you know, that we work with the folks are really hopeful. They really are, and that is, you know, it's refreshing to work with that hope and to help to maintain it. But also, you know, be ready and willing to help negotiate, any kind of challenges they might have if things aren't working out in the relationship. So it's key to engender and maintain hope. So again, as I said, interacting with the world more, going out more, dealing with work and social issues. Couples' interactional cycles, I think, are more fluid in younger couples and with younger people, so that they're willing to try things more in relationships, willing to take more risks. And I think that education around relationships and around PTSD symptoms is more extensive in this population because they're younger and they don't know as much about relationships. And, you know, having worked in this field now for about almost 25 years, it's a very interesting change for me to, instead of being the youngster that works with Vietnam veteran couples, I'm now the old guy that gives wise advice, and it's a very different role and a different experience as a therapist, and kind of fun actually. I actually kind of like it. I had years and years of having patients come in and say, "Well, kid, how are you going to help me?" You know, and now I'm the old guy. In any case, I think the other thing that I noticed is that in their family of origin issues that, again, are more predominant. They're closer to their families. Their families are more in their lives on a day-to-day basis. They're in touch with them more. And so again, getting, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, but getting more of a detailed family history and who's still, you know, in your circle is really, really, I think, significantly important to do. So with Vietnam vets, just briefly, as I said before, the numbing symptoms are more predominant, and physiological arousal reactivity usually decreases as we age. I think that that's, you know, I've seen that to be the case. And I think that a lot of times when folks are coming in for, you know, on their third relationship, my experience is that they really take it seriously, and they want it to work this time, and it matters a great deal. And there's a real appreciation about relationships when you work with older couples that I think is really an honor to get to work with. And I think that also when you're working with couples in which, you know, in which somebody has been diagnosed with PTSD for 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 or more years, that the goal is not, again, the amelioration of the PTSD symptoms, but the goal is acceptance and figuring out how to limit the amount that the PTSD impacts the couple. And I think what Erica said earlier about the idea of externalizing the problem, which is a sort of a narrative therapy term, I think all couples therapies really talk about externalizing the problem, but they do it in slightly different ways. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But here's a, sort of an example of a what I would say is sort of a Vietnam vet couple sitting in the living room. So, would you care to put your filthy paws on me? So I think PTSD does, you know, impacts couples in by making everything a bit careful. Want to make sure everything's safe. Is it okay? So let's talk about treatment. And I think that my work is more and more been influenced by the work of Sue Johnson and John Bowlby, and thinking about attachment and how adult attachment really impacts relationships. And you know, I think that it, you know, as I say here, that it's seeking and maintaining contact is primary motivation in humans, and a secure connection offers a safe haven and a secure base. So attachment, dependence, and security fosters exploration of the world instead of hindering it. So I think this is really an important point, that you know, a lot of times in our culture we really value independence, and I would argue that in order for us to be fully independent, we have to be connected, and relationships and couples relationships are the prime place to foster that connection, to make that connection take place, to help it along. So the idea is to build the bond of accessibility and responsiveness within the relationship. So secure attachment is the antidote to trauma. So traumatic experiences that floods us with physical fear and helplessness. It colors the world as dangerous. It creates overwhelming chaos. It assaults self-efficacy, threatens a cohesive sense of self, scrambles the ability to engage fully in the present. And a secure attachment battles against that. It truly does. If you can have someone to come home to and to talk about what's going on for you internally, it makes all the difference in the world. It really does. I have a couple that I'm working with right now, and he so badly wants to be able to open up and let his partner know what's going on, but he gets very scared about doing that. And he's scared for a couple of reasons. If I talk to you, it means I admit to myself what I'm dealing with. If I talk to you, I'm scared I'm going to overwhelm you and that you won't really be there for me. And I'll end up having to comfort you, and there'll be no place for me. So this is what the couple struggles with. And so the goal here is to have his partner be able to reach out and say, I may get upset, I may get worried about you, I love you, and I'm ready to listen, and I can be there for you. And that is not easy work to do. It sounds wonderful. It's challenging to do for a whole slew of reasons, because mostly because people have developed styles of protection that guard against becoming that intimate with another person, even with a partner. So some of the interventions with OEF-OF couples. Here's a slide I'm proud of just because I made it myself, and I think it's very pretty. But really what I want to focus on here is, and I will be spending most of my time on the assessment phase, sessions 1 through 5. Now, I don't want to suggest that, you know, in the work, in, you know, if you're in my office and you were and I was working with you in somewhere between sessions 1 and 5, that all we would be doing would be assessment. Now, work treatment starts from the first phone call you have contact with somebody, for sure. But during the first 5 sessions, I am trying to figure out what treatment do I think will be most useful for the particular couple that I'm working with. So it may be that couples therapy is not indicated at this point, and that's certainly possible. And we'll talk about some exclusion criteria, at least that I have, and I imagine many of you who are couples therapists would also agree with. I'm also, you know, wondering, is EFT, since, I mean, this is the therapy that I found to be most effective and find that the work that I do most meaningful, is it the appropriate therapy for the particular couple that is coming in to get help from me? And lastly, you know, or is communication and problem-solving therapy more appropriate for a particular couple? So in terms of the exclusion criteria that at least I have, is that I won't see couples where there's active, severe domestic violence. There are some people that provide that service. The Ackerman Institute has a specialty clinic that works with these couples. And it's wonderful work, but it's very intensive work, and it takes a very, very specific skill set, I think, to do it successfully. Some people argue that it's inappropriate always. I'm not so sure it is, but I do think that, at least for the work that I do, that it's an exclusion criteria. Secondly, ongoing affairs are also an exclusion criteria for the work that I do. If the idea is to create a vulnerability with both members of the couple, then there needs to be a safe enough place to do that. And affairs, I believe, as does domestic violence or substance abuse or sociopathy in one or more of the members, preclude that. So I don't think you can do the work if the environment isn't safe. And then for some exclusion criteria for EFT, in addition to the ones that I've listed above, are not willing to engage in at least 8 sessions of couples therapy. And that includes the 5 assessment sessions. So I'm saying that really a couple needs to be able to be willing to work with you for at least 8 sessions. And I think for these couples, the couples we're talking about here, considerably more than 8 sessions. I don't want at all give you the impression that oh, geez, you know, we can do brief therapy with these couples and they'll just be perfect. I don't think that that's the case when we're dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. I think it's slow-going, meaningful work, but it takes time. Other issues where you're not going to do EFT work, couples who are separating. I don't think that you provide emotionally focused couples therapy for, but I do think that therapy for couples who are separating together sometimes can be very, very useful. And we don't get a whole lot of training on that. Bill Pinsoff talks about that in a couple of his presentations, and I think it's really right on, is that, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. You know, we should be spending time training ourselves and our trainees on how to work with those couples that are going to separate and how to help them separate in a very, very positive way, because I think that it can be done with at least a large portion of couples. Couples unable or unwilling to process emotional material. There's some couples that just can't or will not do that. They don't. They feel too unsafe in doing it, and they just won't do it. And in those situations, sometimes a problem-solving model works better for them. And obviously, a therapist's skill level, I think, needs to be high in doing EFT work, and the therapist needs to be very comfortable in working with emotion. So in session 1, you want to join and create an alliance with a couple. And this is, again, you know, kind of the no kidding bullet. But it's also, I mean, we could spend hours talking about what's the best way to create alliance with couples and how best to do it. I always frame sessions, you know, the early sessions as an assessment. I want to get a family tree in the first session, just very briefly, who's at home, just so they get a sense of exactly who the players are that may be impacting what's happening for the couple. And then find out what the initial problem is that they want help with. And weave in with that what they believe the war service, you know, what the connection between the problem that they want help with and the veterans' war service. Usually there's a connection, usually they'll make that connection, but I think it's important to ask. What you're really paying attention to during the early sessions is the couple's interactional cycle, their pattern, so who does what in particular discussions, and I think this is sort of the crucial ingredient here, a thing to be thinking about is typically couples do the same darn thing over and over again, and the question is figuring out what that thing is and helping them pay attention to what that thing is, and in a way doing what Erica talked about was externalizing the problem. And so instead of utilizing the externalizing the problem language, you would utilize the how is the cycle victimizing the two of you, causing difficulties to the two of you. So you begin to talk about the interactional patterns as being the problem as opposed to, you know, your partner or you being the problem. And by creating that distance, the couple then gets to take a look at the pattern from a little bit of a distance and be able to work together to try to change the pattern. So it's a way of creating we-ness in a relationship and creating some distance from the actual problem in and of itself. What you're also going to be doing is, obviously, you need to talk with couples about the strengths of their relationship. Neil Jacobson talks about this in one of his books, which I thought was a really brilliant comment, which has to do with just making sure that the first session isn't all about the problem, that people come in demoralized. Usually they come into couples therapy because they've tried everything they possibly could, and boy, they want some help, and they're not feeling real good about the relationship. And so it's important not to avoid talking about the problem, but to make sure that there's time to talk about the strengths of the couple and why the relationship matters so much that they're there to get help. So, and I think that, you know, the other piece is you're going to be educating regarding PTSD or other war-related symptoms, and that education is going to go ongoing. So instead of educating, you know, in the first couple of sessions, my experience is that you educate as particular issues arise, because then the salient points stay with your couple or family, I think, much more, that stays with them for a much longer period of time than if you just give them a wrap, you know, a blurb on PTSD and symptoms and how it affects people. I think it only works, it's much better when it's connected to a particular issue that the couple is struggling with. So installation of hope, I'm going to move a little quickly through the rest of my slides here as I got the high sign. Installation of hope is absolutely crucial in the first session. Nothing more important than that. So I think that, you know, getting a sense of how the couple met, this can give you a real sense of what you have in the relationship to work with. How people talk about that first meeting will tell you whether or not there's a lot of juice left in the relationship or not. It doesn't create any kind of exclusion criteria, but I think it is significant to notice how people respond to that issue, that conversation. So again, you want to just continue to develop the understanding of the interactional cycle that the couple is engaging in. So who does what? How does that play itself out? And if couples are recently returned from war, then you're really going to be spending some time just having them get to know each other again. I think Erica did a nice job of talking about that and about who does what at home, and, you know, what sorts of roles does the returning partner want, and what sort of roles does the partner who's been at home want to give them, and to have that conversation clarified so that any kind of misunderstandings or difficulties can get avoided. So in sessions 3-4, what I do is I really think that it's important to have individual sessions with each member of the couple to really get to know their own history. I think you got to be clear about what your particular rules are around confidentiality. I take the position that if you meet with me individually, it's not confidential for the purposes of the couple's work. Other people may disagree with that, but I found that to be a fairly useful strategy. And I utilize a few questionnaires that I think are helpful in assessing the couple. One is the Dyadic Adjustment Scale, which is a pretty standard satisfaction measure that has been used in research for a long time. The Conflict Tactics Scale, which measures any kind of violence that's in the relationship. Substance Abuse Assessment. And then I utilize something from the Emotionally Focused Therapy Workbook, which is an interactional cycle assessment, which is really asking the couple, what do you do in the cycle? Like, what do you do? And when your partner does this, what do you do? And how do you react to that? So it's just getting their blow by blow, and then you get to match those between the two members of the couple to see, are they on the same page in terms of who does what? And that then helps you get a better understanding of the cycle and of itself. So you're going to be, this is the time to strengthen the alliance with each member of the couple, to gather more individual information. And you want to make sure, if there is any history of trauma, that that we don't neglect the partner's history of trauma, because a lot of times the emphasis and the focus and sort of the spotlight's on the veteran. And I certainly try not to make that error in the couples work that I do, that the partner is as important as the veteran in the work that I do. And getting a good history on the partner's experience and their own relationship with trauma, I think, is usually very, very helpful. The other question that I ask, this is again directly from Sue Johnson's work, is get a sense of their attachment history early on. So who did they go to when they were hurt? And I think if there's a hard time answering that question, or if you begin to get a little more information around what happened when they went to that person and whether or not they got rejected, you're going to see that information will inform how challenging the therapy may end up being. That if they didn't have an attachment figure, somebody that they could go to, that they could feel connected to, when they were younger, that in fact they may end up having those same difficulties in the room with you. So in session 5, you're going to be reviewing the results of questionnaires. You're going to continue your understanding of the cycle. And again, you want to really deepen each member's understanding of the cycle by looking at primary and secondary emotions that drive the cycle. So people get into certain patterns, whether they pursue and withdraw, and there may be criticism and stonewalling that we see. And we see this in all couples, and a lot of times in veteran couples, the partners will be criticizing or pursuing, and the vet will maybe feel overwhelmed, but will just shut down and withdraw. And really understanding what's going on a deeper emotional level for each member of the couple allows for a very, very important dialogue to take place within the relationship. So if you learn that the reason why your partner keeps on asking you a particular question isn't because she wants to bother you, not at all. It's because she cares so deeply and you affect her so much that she really just wants to know what's going on for you. And for a withdrawn spouse, stonewalling spouse, it's possible that he's just not sure how to respond. And that's because he doesn't want to make a mistake because of how important she is to him. But that conversation doesn't take place typically at home, at least not initially. That conversation needs to be elicited by a therapist who can really help the couple understand exactly what their partner is going through. So I'm almost out of time. I'm going to just do a couple more slides here. Again, 3 to 30 weekly one-hour sessions. That's in addition to the 5 sessions I talked about. So 8 to 30 one-hour. I would suggest probably longer if you're doing EFT, I mean, up to like 20 to 30 sessions would not be a surprising number of sessions with a traumatized population. And again, the goal in my mind is that the vet gets to lean on the partner and the partner gets to lean on the vet. That's really what where you're going for. I'm going to kind of crank through a few more things here. Again, I think successful therapy will allow couples to solve problems more easily. Do you want to titrate the sessions to monthly, then quarterly? I do want to emphasize that sometimes couples in which they have chronic PTSD may be a long-term and supportive modality. So I think that the literature doesn't talk a lot about couples therapy that lasts 3, 4, 5 years. I think that with chronic PTSD couples, I think that is not necessarily, I don't see that as a real problem, and think that it's actually more of a standard of care that goes on that nobody talks about. So again, I think that there's also a little bit of a debate in the field between self-soothing and other soothing strategies. I think the CBT therapies focus more on the self-soothing, EFT focuses more on other soothing, and I think the bottom line is that, that improvement in self-soothing and other soothing strategies, I think, are important. Okay, I'm going to quickly talk. I mean, I've got a couple more slides I want to talk in terms of talking about war experiences. So the key ingredient here is it important in relation to the goal of the therapy to talk about war experiences, and is it going to be safe? And figuring out what details the events should be discussed. And couples and family therapy do not have to involve the direct discussion of trauma. Discussion of effects of trauma can be as useful as the discussion of the trauma itself. And it really, really depends on the couple and on the particular issues. A lot of times vets flip into a black and white thinking that I can't tell her anything or I have to tell her everything. And there is a big, big chasm between those two points. And maybe there are some things you can tell her, and there also you can also tell her how whatever you went through in particular, how it's really affecting you right now. So the veteran's fears are that around talking, the partner will be infected, the partner will be burdened or highly distressed, that the veteran will then remember more and become more symptomatic, and the veteran will lose control, and the veteran will appear weak or needy. The partner's fears is that they'll say the wrong things, they'll somehow screw it up, they'll lose control, they won't understand, and that their pain is too much to bear. So if you're gonna do this, the environment needs to be safe. Partner needs to be ready to respond appropriately. That can come with some coaching from the therapist. You want to choose a time and a place so it can happen in your office. It can happen at home. It really depends on where the couple is at and their ability to negotiate this conversation. And I think it's important to get clear the level of detail you want to share, and also exactly how the partner should respond according to the veteran, and definitely include a cool down time. So again, there are other interventions that may be useful. Individual or group or medication therapy can certainly be helpful. Community interventions are really, really important. And it doesn't end with the DOD, the VA, or the vet center. That really, the Coming Home Project is a key ingredient, and other community-based programs are the key ingredient in really helping our veterans and their partners successfully negotiate the challenges of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are lots of things that you can do. One is be a part of the Coming Home Project. There are other organizations like Give an Hour and the Soldiers Project as well, but I'm partial to the Coming Home Project. My friend runs it and does a great job. And lastly, I just wanted to thank you, and I think I'm ready for questions. So thank you. Sure. Yes.
One question I have is about payment and how veterans are covered and their families and for how long.
Yeah, that's a great question. And Erica, you just tell me if I make a mistake. OEF, OIF veterans are covered for 5 years from their from their return from war. So everything is free in terms of obtaining couples therapy through, at least through the VA, it's free. And I believe that it's obtaining couples or family therapy through the vet center is, I don't know if there is a 5-year, there's no 5-year timeline, I don't believe. It's free for forever. So there's no charge at all. I believe what's going to happen, and that's for veterans in which there isn't any kind of a service-connected disability established. If there is a service-connected disability established, then it will be free for life. So now what the VA doesn't do, which the Vet Center does do, is provide individual therapy for spouses, and I think they do some work with kids. Probably depends on the Vet Center. But what the VA does do is they provide, at least the San Francisco VA I can speak for, they provide couples and family therapy and will do some individual work, but that has to be built into the couples or the family work. We also have a spouse support group at our VA as well. Other questions?
I'd just like to add, Keith, that the three groups you mentioned, the Coming Home Project in Northern California, Give an Hour around the country, and the Soldiers Project, mostly in Southern California, offer pro bono services with highly trained therapists, and there's no exclusion, very few exclusionary criteria, and people can be seen for as long as they need. And we see extended family as well as the veterans. So they're another resource. And in time, we will also be offering support groups and classes and other kinds of things. Keith, I wondered if you might say anything about the struggles, say, a spouse or family member might go through that might lead to depression and hopelessness and even thoughts of suicide.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Joe. This is a big issue. I mean, I think the thing that we need to remember is that PTSD does not just affect an individual. It affects a community, and it especially affects those people who love the person afflicted with PTSD. What we know from, this comes from some Israel research, is that it's very common that if your partner has developed PTSD, and this is with a military sample, that you, in fact, will develop or can develop a lot of symptoms of depression, hopelessness, feeling alone, feeling cut off from your wider social network, somatic complaints. And think about it. If your partner is is suffering from PTSD and is cut off from their greater social world, then you too may end up being cut off from your social network and from your support. So, thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you who are watching, all of you who are here. Next year, this series will include programs on children, on women veterans, on spirituality, on thinking outside the box, alternative modes of treatment, on student veterans, the growing number of student veterans, and how we can best help them. So to conclude, I'd like to share my heartfelt thanks to Erica Curran and Keith Armstrong for your terrific presentations. Let's show our appreciation again, if we'd like. ComingHomeProject.net if you're interested in our programs. Thank you all very much.